Welcome to The Better Side, interviews about hope and change in an era of fear and uncertainty. My name is Eoin O'Riordan, and my guest today is Maureen De Burke, a feminist campaigner, human rights activist, closely associated with housing campaigns, and also, most recently, the credit union movement. You're very welcome, Maureen.
Thank you.
Now, Maureen, we've met before and we've had a few chats in the past, and I want you maybe to just to tell the story of being a little girl growing up in County Kildare, and the thing that got you politically motivated or that opened your mind to politics and the wider world. It's a story about you going down to the local library and taking out the biggest books that you could find.
That's right, because the library, for some odd reason, had very limited opening hours. And I lived 2 miles outside the town, so I didn't get in and out that often. It was a big, big deal to cycle in and get books. Anyway, I decided that I would take out the biggest books on the shelves, and that would see me through to the next opening time. And on one particular occasion, the book I took out was called The Young Irelanders. It was written by T.D. Sullivan, who I think wrote Who Fears to Speak of 98. You know the song?
Yeah.
I think. Anyway, it was by him. And all it wasn't anything special in a book. It was a series of little tiny biographies of the Young Irelanders. And I don't know what it was, but that was it. Up to that, you see, I had decided I was going to be a nun.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's a bit of a revelation. Have you ever said that before?
I had actually picked out the order. It was the Missionary Sisters of St. Columban.
Right.
And they operated in Carrickon, County Clare. To this day, I can remember the order I was going to join.
And what age were you when you made this? I went to a convent school,
and every now and again, a nun would come in with pictures and slides of the missions.
Right.
And the work they were doing. And what really attracted me was not so much being a nun and all the prayer and things like that. It was working in the fields and everything. I was a real outdoor person. I loved animals. I loved being out, sowing things, planting things, digging things up. And I thought, yeah, this would be a nice way to spend your life. So that lasted until I read The Young Irelanders by T.D. Sullivan.
So it's Newbridge Library's fault that you didn't join the religious life.
Exactly. They can blame Newbridge Library.
Right.
But before that, funnily enough, when I was brought up in the States until I was 9.
Okay.
And we came home in 1947, and there was an election in 1948. That was the election that saw Fianna Fáil ousted for the first time.
And the big Clan the Public election.
Clan the Public, Clan Athlone,
right.
All the little parties came into government. And it was the government that had the
mother and child schemes. But I remember, I was
10. And I remember sitting down and thinking, I'm a citizen of Ireland. I really should know what's going on in it politically. I mean, I must have been somewhere off the wall, 10. Deciding I was. So I got the paper every morning and I started reading all the political speeches. I think it was, you see, my father was very political.
Okay.
When we were in America, he was a fierce Republican, funnily enough. Most Irish people in America are Democrats.
Right.
But he was
Republican in the American sense.
He was Republican,
right.
Solely because the Republicans were isolationists. They didn't want to join in with Britain in the war.
Right.
And my father was so anti-British. So bitterly anti-British.
And had he been involved in the War of Independence era?
I think he had some, mildly.
And why did your parents move to America? I mean, it's an obvious question, but they managed to move back, which is unusual.
Daddy had a good job here. He was a carpenter with the OPW.
Okay.
And my father's gate that he built for Lochcutra Castle is still up.
Wow.
And it was a wooden gate about as high as this room, and it hasn't a nail in it.
Wow.
It's a fantastic structure, and it's still there.
So you're 10 years of age.
10 years of age, and I decide I have to know what's going on politically in Ireland. I got bored, rigid. I mean, I gave it up very shortly, because, I mean, imagine 10 years old reading all the political speeches. Come on. I mean, it was a good idea, but it just goes to show that I was politically motivated even before I read The Young Irelanders.
But there's a lot happening in 1940 around the time.
There was
a teacher strike, for example. There was the first time that people began to ask big questions about where Ireland was going.
Yes,
and half time in the All Ireland final, the INTO had a march on the pitch at Croke Park, and there was a presidential election around that time, and
there was maybe that was it. Maybe there was so much going on.
Yeah, so much
but
going
also
on.
It was the first time anybody questioned Dev.
Right.
Really,
a
wasn't
big thing.
It?
Yeah,
that was a big thing. Like the movement was away from Fianna Fáil,
but he'd been in power since 1932.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So you were influenced by that kind of.
So then I decided to join Sinn Féin, but I was too young, so I had to, I patiently waited until my 16th birthday.
Right.
When you could legally, or when you could join Sinn Féin, and I went down. And I joined Sinn Féin. There was a branch in Newbridge.
Okay, and that was the 1950s.
That would have been 16. 38, born 38, 48, 54, isn't it?
Okay. 54. And would you have known some of the big names around that time? The leadership of Sinn Féin?
No, I wouldn't have known the leadership. Okay. No, we would have been a small common in a small town.
And what was political activity like in Newbridge for
16-year-olds? Selling Easter lilies. The funny thing is, you know, and this is, people don't understand this. The first political collection I made at the church gate was for the prisoners. There were prisoners in England from a failed arms raid.
Right.
And the person sitting beside me, you'd have a table and a couple of chairs in those days outside the church for your collection. And the person sitting beside me was a strong, well-known member of Fine Gael.
Right.
Christy Moore's father.
Okay.
Andy.
Right.
And that was the politics of the time, were that a member of Fine Gael could sit beside a member of Sinn Féin making a collection for Republican
prisoners.
Political prisoners in England.
Yeah.
Weird, when you look back on it.
And so you would have been sort of supportive of border campaigns around that time and armed action and all that?
Very much so. Okay. Yeah, very much so.
Okay. And then at what stage did you begin to... Did feminism come into your mindset, or was it always there?
No, feminism came much later. Feminism came as a result of the civil rights movement in America. And of course, at that stage, there were a lot of people coming over from America, and they'd come up to the office and we'd chat, and, you know, young women would come up and they were in the feminist movement in America. It was it was really that. It kind of came from abroad, if you like.
Okay. But in looking at your background, even though you have been a member of quite a number of political parties, Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party and all the rest of it, it's more the issues that you're associated with rather than party political activities.
I left Sinn Féin for a while because it wasn't going anywhere. So there were a few years when I was actually out of it. And then the telephonists went on strike, and they were mostly young women. And they were appallingly paid in every way. And I remember being fiercely in favour of their strike.
Right.
And Sinn Féin came out with a supporting statement, which really rocked me. Because, you know, up to that, they wouldn't have supported a strike. They were, you know, they were very right-wing when I joined them.
Okay.
And the fact that they put out this statement supporting the telephonists, I went back and rejoined.
Okay.
And the following, I think it could have been the following Ardesh, there was the real big pooch, if that's the way you pronounce that word.
Right.
Against the old guard. And people like Cathal Goulding and Tomás Magyala and even at that stage, funnily enough, given his later record, Rúrí Óbrádaigh, they were the new guard.
Okay.
And Cathal had spent a lot of his time in jail reading left-wing literature. So he was very much to the left, and which suited me fine at that stage. I kind of had gradually moved to the left. You can do that in your lifetime without noticing it. You know, you don't sit down. You don't sit down.
You never write it down and say,
"I
never
believed
this."
You don't sit down one day and say, "Gosh, I'm left wing." It kind of creeps up on you. You know, you take stances on.
Right.
On various things.
And all of a sudden there's a thread going through.
The big thing
them.
Of that for me, and I'll tell you a wee story if you like, about my father came home from America. My father was very bigoted. Very bigoted.
In what way? Anti-British?
Anti-black.
Oh, right. Okay.
Irish in America are. You have to recognise
I'm aware of that, yeah.
And he was always talking about niggers and things. But anyway, he sat down one day and he told us a story of when we weren't there. We came home first. He finished off his time to get his pension. And so after work, he'd go into the pub, have a drink. And he was in the pub and this black man came in for a drink and walked up to the bar. And the barman ordered him out. And Daddy was really pleased at this. But without thinking, without even thinking about it, I said, and if I had been there, Daddy, I'd have walked out with him. And when I went to bed that night, I lay there awake for ages thinking, where did that come from? Because I had had no opinion on black versus white whatsoever. And that's the way it creeps up on you. You don't realise. I'm sure other people have found this, that suddenly they find they have an opinion which they didn't know they had.
Okay. And what do you attribute that to? Where would that have come from?
I have absolutely no idea. I just thought the injustice of a man coming in after work, like my dad, wanting a drink and being ordered out because of the colour of his skin.
And what was your dad's reaction to...
Well, everybody looked at me as if I had just suddenly grown two heads. I really was aghast myself.
Right.
And then, of course, you sit down, you think about it, and you say, I do that. But I did not know where that had come from. And I'm sure we all here have done that without thinking about it. That suddenly an opinion comes out. So, in a way, the feminism thing gradually grew too. I remember fighting like mad. I was always in a trade union. I was in the pre-impact trade union. I can't remember the name of it now. It was up there up near Parnell Square.
Yeah.
But they wanted to get an increase in wages for us. And it was 10 bob for the men and 5 bob for the women. And I fought that tooth and nail. But it wasn't really... I suppose it was feminism, a form of feminism. I wouldn't have understood feminism if you had mentioned it to me, because I'm going back now to the
early 60s. It might be different things to different people, but feminism is the bizarre notion that men and women are equal.
Yeah, indeed, yes. How quaint. But I did fight like that, but didn't see it as feminism. I saw it as being very unjust, and I had the same bills coming in as the man sitting next to me, you know.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. So I suppose that's where... What happened in America was that the women joined the civil rights movement and suddenly discovered that they were being told to go and make the tea and lick the stamps and that they weren't getting any recognition, and they weren't being given any serious role in the movement. And that started them off.
So you described a split in Sinn Féin. That must have been the one, obviously, the early 70s.
68.
And
69, actually. 69,
yes. So Provisional Sinn Féin would have come out of that, and you would have been delighted because all the Conservatives in your mind are gone.
And so annoyed with Micah Riordan.
No relation, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. I'm always accused of being a relation to Micah Riordan, the former Communist Party leader.
And a great comrade. I mean, he was outdone most of our things now. But Mick, the Communists at that time had this thing about the Mensheviks. We were the Mensheviks. The Mensheviks were the ones... The Mensheviks were the ones who kind of got the revolution started.
Right.
But the Bolsheviks were the ones who came in, did away with all the Mensheviks and established the communist state.
Right.
So we were the Mensheviks.
And this stuff is really important for people on the left, but most people in the country
wouldn't know what I was talking about. But it's very interesting in that Mick Riordan saw the split as a disaster.
Right.
Because it was splitting the Mensheviks.
Okay.
And that was a disaster. We should be kept together to start the revolution off so that he and his hordes could come in and finish it off.
Okay.
And he kept trying to speak to people and bring them together, to my intense irritation.
But was the North important to you? Was the civil rights movement important to you? Was sectarianism important to you?
Civil rights was very important. Sectarianism was very important. The national question became less important. I don't know why, I don't know why. The national question itself became less important as the other issues, to me.
At that time, in
some way, I think I saw it as a distraction. It certainly was a distraction in the women's movement.
Okay.
Because you'd women going off, and I remember one, what I would have considered a strong feminist, saying the real issue today is the national question. And I remember saying to her, this is absolute nonsense. It is not the main issue today.
And would you have been heavily involved in the Housing Action Campaign around that time?
And that would have had a lot to do with it, because the day of Bloody Sunday, I was with a woman that we had put squatting in a house in Drumcondra, and she was being evicted. And I really, it came at the wrong time for me, as a juxtaposition, if you like, because I couldn't even think about what was happening in the North. Here was a woman, she had a small child, and it was very cold weather. There was actually snow on the ground, and she was being evicted. And that was that weekend that Bloody Sunday happened.
Okay.
So it kind of put things in perspective a little bit for me.
Because you were dealing with very, very if you like, bread and butter
immediate issues
here. Immediate, given in Dublin.
Yeah, given a choice, of course I'd like to see United Ireland. I think a United Ireland only makes sense in every way possible. But, and particularly now that we've got rid of all this nonsense in the Constitution about the Church.
Right.
And the fact that the Irish people are no longer wedded to Rome.
Yeah.
I mean, that isn't so anymore.
But it was always the social issues. There was the social agenda, the socialism, that was more important to you than nationalism?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
It was. It became more
important. Tell me about the Housing Action Campaign, where it came from and why it was so important.
Because people mightn't
remember it.
Well, it came from the fact that, I told you about the takeover of the leadership in the party.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, left-wing people took over. And I think even maybe without knowing it, they wanted to move away from this pure nationalistic gun
obsession with Northern Ireland.
Exactly.
Right.
And of course, they were left-wing people. They were socialists. So they wanted, and they looked around them and saw that there were grave, you know, inequalities in society.
Right.
So it was one of our members said that the worst problem in Dublin was housing. And he was right.
Mm-hmm.
So he set up the Dublin Housing Action Committee. And I joined it, and we started. And the big deal for us was that nobody would admit there was a crisis. Even the Labour Party wouldn't admit there was a crisis. Now, there were very right-wing people on the Labour Party executive in those days. But they wouldn't accept. And a great part of our whole campaign was based on getting them to accept. Once they accepted, and that's what, in fact, in the end happened, people did accept there was a crisis, and they started building houses and things. I mean, we were successful in what we didn't set out to build houses.
Yeah,
we set out that the politicians, the councillors mainly, would recognise that there were 10,000 families on the housing list, and what housing there was in incredibly bad condition.
You wrote a letter to the Irish Times over the Christmas about Apollo House, and I thought it was very interesting because what you said was, what happened with Apollo House over this Christmas period was very similar to what you were doing. Apollo House wasn't an attempt to solve the housing crisis.
No, it
was an attempt to provide a service for a short period of time. But more importantly, it was to highlight the issue.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what you were doing
in
the 60s and 70s.
Exactly. We couldn't solve the housing crisis. We hadn't the power, we hadn't the resources. So we never set out to solve the housing crisis. But we felt quite rightly that if we could get the politicians to accept there was a housing crisis, that there shouldn't be 10,000 people, and that people shouldn't be living. I mean, you have no idea what the condition of housing was at that time and what people were living in.
Even after the great house building of the 40s and 50s and 60s?
No, people were still... I was up in a house in Benburg, not that particular one, Gardner Street, the bottom of Gardner Street, up at the top of a house. And I couldn't understand why the baby's cot was in the middle of the floor, because we all had to walk round it to get to anything. There was a bloody big hole in the floor. The cot was stopping people from falling through into the room downstairs. I mean, and that's only one suggestion. Ben Burb Street, were you ever in Ben? You're too young. Mm. Ben Burb Street flats. Oh, the most appalling living conditions. Mm. One tap, 3 or 4 storey building. One tap in the hall, which was where everybody got their water.
Right.
One loo outside.
See, this is the criticism of nationalism, is that when everybody's talking about Irish Ireland and speaking Irish and playing Gaelic football and all the rest of it, stories like that weren't being told.
No, and indeed the people who were speaking Irish and playing Gaelic games, both of which I love, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm only sorry I cannot speak the language, but I am so, you know, I love it.
Mm.
I love listening to people speaking it, but they didn't support us in any way.
Okay.
We never got any support from national organisations.
Okay. Tell me the story about the woman who, and you told me the story before, so I'm keying it up for you, if you like, but there's a story you told me before about a woman having been evicted, her husband down the pub, her children all around her, and for some bizarre reason she feels sorry for you.
Yes, we were sitting on the floor. There was a lull. There was always a lull when the sheriff pulled back to see, I suppose, to get his orders. Was he to carry out the eviction, because there was resistance? And we were sitting on the floor.
Where about? This is Dublin City Centre somewhere.
It was probably, again, it was probably the flats there in Gardner Street.
Okay.
We sat on the floor and we were shooting the breeze, as the Americans say. And she asked me, was I married?
Right.
And I said no. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh," just like that. And I knew that that came from the heart. With all her troubles, she was, her heart went out to me.
But that's the
and I just
in,
thought
I
when she got her when she got the date for the eviction, the husband took off to the pub.
Right.
That's where he was. The children, God love them, lovely children, but hardly a stitch on them, and you know, their nose running.
Right.
Three or four of them, with 9 months between them. And she felt sorry for me because I didn't have a man.
Okay.
And all I could do was laugh, you know. But she was a pussycat of a lady. Yeah. She was gorgeous.
But that's the,
and we saved her flat for her.
But when we, and that's isn't it fascinating, the, you know, the status that women had at that,
yes,
at that time?
Yes, absolutely.
You know? And when I, yeah, when I tell people about my mother who moved to Dublin from Cavan back in the day and had to leave her work in the civil service when she got married,
yes,
people look at me as if I'm mad. Tell me about Richard Nixon's visit and an egg.
Yes.
Because I was going, I'm dying to ask you if you ever saw any military action, but maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I shouldn't ask that question, seeing as you were close.
Well, unless you'd call that, I have no military.
No, right.
No. But well, Nixon,
the closest thing, you launch a missile at Richard Nixon.
Nixon was coming, and of course, in the middle of the Vietnam War, which we had been out day and night at the American embassy, but of course, he wasn't going to get away without. So we decided that eggs were non-violent.
Right.
It wouldn't hurt, wouldn't hurt him.
We is who? We is what?
Kind of a left-wingish group.
Okay.
There was no kind of a... It wasn't the Irish Voice in Vietnam now. It was, right. They were very respectable.
A loose alignment of
youngsters, really, I suppose, youngish people. But I had a pal working in the abattoir.
Right.
And I asked him, would he get me a couple of bottles of blood? And he said he would. So what we decided to do was take down the flag and burn it. But I wanted... The American flag. But I wanted the whole of the steps covered in blood because it was an anti-war protest.
Okay, which steps now, sorry?
The ones on the Marion Road. The ones of the American Embassy.
Okay, so he would...
That's a different one. The Nixon one. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Nixon was eggs.
Okay, well, I'll have to ask about the blood one now.
And I had
there's obviously a few of them.
I had a young lad with me from the north and he came with me. He was keen to get involved and we went into a shop and bought half a dozen eggs and I gave him three and I put three in my pocket. And I was disguised. I had a headscarf on me and sunglasses because the guards would know me 100 miles away at that
stage.
Well,
you're a very well-known campaigner at that time.
Yes, so I didn't want them to see me because they'd haul you out, you see, and put you into protective custody.
So there you were.
So there it was. And somebody had told me, I have a lousy shot. But somebody told me that if you do a lob, like that.
Somebody told you?
Somebody told me this, that if you do a lob, you're much more
Wasn't one of the Group B people by any chance?
Possibly. Anyway, I did a lob and I got it dead on in the middle of the windscreen.
Now, I can only imagine if that happened today that you would be shot dead.
Well, I was nearly shot dead because one of the cameramen, the Irish Times cameraman who was in the car behind, heard them getting excited and somebody saying, "It's all right, it's only an egg, it's only an egg," which God only knows what he was trying to calm
down.
Well,
this is only a few years after Candy would have been shot.
Yeah,
no, it went to 10 or 15, 10 years after Candy, so there would have been a bit on edge.
And I never thought of that.
Yeah.
I'd be very annoyed if
I'd
been shot.
So you allowed an egg.
If I'd been shot, I would have been most distracted.
And did you then have to tell the world as to why you threw an egg at Richard Nixon's
car? Oh, no, they knew. Vietnam was very much in the thing.
The blood and the abattoir.
The blood, yeah.
And
well, that was Vietnam.
Who was that for?
That was Vietnam.
I know, but what was the? Oh, it was just.
There was a huge big. There was a huge big march going to march on Washington in America on Vietnam, and I thought, well, we better support.
So the idea was just to
take down the flag, burn it, and I wanted blood all over the steps. So we got there.
I don't know why I'm laughing.
I left the lads to deal with the flag. And I went up to the top of the steps. I tell you, this is, and I do believe it's the one thing now, I'm nearing 80, but the one thing I would go on now is anti-war. I do feel that war is so awful. But anyway, I went up to the top of the steps and I smashed the two bottles. Beautiful splatter of blood all over the steps. It was so effective. I was proud of myself.
Of course, right. Brilliant. And what was the reaction
then? That was what I eventually got 3 months jail for.
You got 3 months in jail for putting blood on this. 3 months? Really?
Yeah, that's what I served time for.
And that's the only time you ever served time?
Well, I was in and out but got bailed and things like that and it never went any further, but that was the only serious. I was in for a week on contempt of when we
what was the charge?
When There is a charge of doing something nasty in a foreign territory.
Oh, right.
And that was foreign territory. I was on American.
Even the steps?
I was on American soil. There is some kind of funny charge.
So 3 months. In where did you serve the 3 months?
Mountjoy.
Was that tough?
It wasn't pleasant. It wasn't pleasant. Anybody who tells you prison is a doddle, it is not a doddle.
And who? What? I mean.
I had colleagues. I had two. There was three women and one man were identified. They asked the Marine to come down and identify the people who had done it. And this is Americans. He wouldn't identify everybody, even though we were all arrested at it. He only arrested the people he recognised. There's a certain honour in Americans, daft and mad as a bag of frogs as they are. There is a certain level of honour. He wouldn't identify the others who were clearly there. They were arrested with us.
Right.
He arrested three men and a woman. And we were the ones who served
and you
time.
Don't have American citizenship around
you?
You do? And that didn't get you out of trouble?
It doesn't, no.
No, three months.
I didn't pursue my American citizenship until I needed to go to the States on a speaking tour.
Okay.
And then they didn't want to give it to me because I was a person of moral turpitude.
That's a T-shirt, if ever I heard one.
Moral turpitude was the reason they gave for not giving me my passport.
Right, that's kind of like a badge of honour almost, is it?
Absolutely. Okay. But they had to give it to me in the end because both my parents had been naturalised.
Right, okay. So, what a journey. I mean, I've been indicated here from Donny there's only 4 minutes left and I wish it was 44 minutes. Feminism is very important to you. I want to ask about the credit union movement because I know that's very important to you as well. Mm. Ireland and women's rights and where we are now, from the time you were born to Ireland now, massive change, but how do you feel the movement is?
There's a way to go, but it is a massive change and you have to give it to the young women. The young women of each generation, if you like. Because when you go on a demo now, it's all young women and it's lovely, you know, to see them. They have different ideas and different ways of going about things, but they are out there and they know what they want. No, there's been a massive change and I wouldn't downplay it at all. It's been great.
So what's the next big...
the 8th.
But political representation at all is still quite low.
I honestly believe, and I'm going to say it now publicly because it doesn't matter. I think if a woman wants an abortion, she should be able to get an abortion.
Would you have been able to say that 30 years ago?
No.
What has changed then in the last period of time for you to be able to say
that? Well, what has changed with me is I don't care anymore and I don't have a political party looking over my shoulder.
Right.
You know, because you have to toe the party line, otherwise what's the point of being in a party?
Yeah. But do you remember the divisiveness of that campaign? Do you remember the
80s? It was horrendous, yes, it was horrendous. I know the abortion thing is, but you know, it's something, and I think it's something, and you know, press and company accepted. I don't think a man has a say in it. I really don't. I think it's a woman's issue, and if it's such a personal issue.
Yeah.
There is no other issue like it.
And have you always felt that? Has this always been your position?
I've always felt if a woman didn't want to bear a child, she shouldn't be forced to.
Because when the legislation came in the 60s in Britain, and when the Cork case happened in the States in the 70s, but did that permeate around here that something similar should happen in Ireland? I mean, the resistance and the Age Amendment originally, I think, came from those two developments in Britain and the USA.
The previous referenda, they were the ones that made people think about it. Up to that, people wouldn't have thought about it.
Yeah.
And yet you will find, I am certain, that women aborted pregnancies. A woman, say, with 10 children and a husband not working, do you think, other than that, there was infanticide?
Because you would have
remembered. And that happened too.
You would have remembered, you know.
I remember TB, for God's sake.
Yeah.
When we came home from America, my mother would ask neighbours, well, how was Johnny so-and-so? And honest to God, 9 times out of 10, the answer was, he died of TB.
Consumption. And that's the big challenge to national movements in Ireland is that, you know, TB was killing people.
And they were worrying about the border.
And women with 13, 14 kids and all the rest of it. So it's still something now that you feel strongly about.
Are you
positive that it can be changed?
The 8th Amendment? Yes.
You are?
I am. I think people will do the right thing.
Okay.
I do.
Give me 1 minute on the, because Donny here is giving me 1 minute. 1 minute on the credit union movement and why it's important.
Well, very important still.
Because you're involved in the Fairview.
Yeah, originally to keep people away from money lenders, and still to a degree, there are money lenders still out there. And just making life easier for people now that the banks have proven what shits they are, if you'll excuse my expression. No, and small loans.
It's a serious editing it is program, I think, Tony. I think we're bunched. Come on, anyway, yeah.
But small loans that banks wouldn't, you know, that you wouldn't. And keeping your house together. I mean, the credit union movement kept my house upright at a time when I wouldn't have had a lot of money. And yeah. It does that for everybody.
Well, look, it's been an absolute education talking to you, Maureen, from schoolgirl in the library, from activists to getting 3 months for throwing an egg at Richard Nixon, to keeping people in their homes, to your belief in inequality of the genders, to just being an all around fantastic person, and continuing to do so in For Every Credit Union. Maureen de Burke, it's been great to have you.
Thank you.